Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are you ready for a future of self-driving cars, human organs churned out by 3D printers, and computers more intelligent than the humans who built them? What about the effects of accelerated climate change and the suffering and conflict likely to go along with it? Extrapolating from current scientific, economic, and geopolitical progress to visualize the future is challenging on its own. But my guest believes we also have an obligation to ourselves and to future generations to do what we can now to ensure the future is as peaceful, productive, and just as it has the potential to be. Dr. James Canton is CEO and chairman of the Institute for Global Futures. His new book is called Future Smart: Managing the Game-Changing Trends That Will Transform Your World. Jamie, welcome to Think.
Thanks for inviting me.
One of your goals in visualizing the future is to prepare people to take steps to shape that future rather than simply letting it happen. Is it equally important to focus on the potential negatives as the positives?
Without a doubt. You can't have one without the other. Everything is really both a risk and an opportunity. If you're unaware of it, if you're unaware of the potential negatives of, let's say, artificial intelligence or autonomous weapons or self-driving cars or you name it, geoengineering, if you're unaware of what could be the negative effects, then at the end of the day, you end up maybe being at the impact of those. You wouldn't want that.
Medicine is one field that seems poised for a dramatic shift in focus. In the future, we won't wait until we get sick to treat disease. Tell us how that would work.
Well, today you wait for something to happen. It's very episodic. Things occur. You get a pain someplace, you have an accident, you see a rash, or you come down with a disease. By then, of course, you've got to head to the doctor or the hospital to figure out what's up. So we don't really have the kind of deep dive glimpse into our future, our health future. Very shortly, though, with the mapping of the human genome, where it will become almost given away, it'll become less than $100, where we have the ability to be able to analyze before we get sick what the potential drivers or precursors of illness might be. That could save our society billions of dollars and extend our lives and our health, make us more productive, but also reduce suffering dramatically. And those technologies are coming really quickly.
Of course, just about everybody right now is aware of the importance of things like healthy diet and exercise and sleep habits, but a lot of people don't seem to be motivated by that to take good care of their bodies. Will it be different in the future that we sort of know exactly what will happen with some certainty if we don't take these proactive steps?
Well, we know a lot of that today, quite frankly. We have reduced almost 75% of all heart attacks and strokes from long-term use of cardiovascular prescriptions such as statins, right? And we already know that we could reduce about half of the diabetes out there by controlling diet. So consumers have been given this information, and certainly healthcare providers have been given the information, but the connecting of the dots really hasn't brought as many people into using what we have today. I would forecast, you're going to end up having where your next job may be in the future, they will mandate that you have to take care of yourself. In fact, there are some companies that only give bonuses and maybe only advance you and only give you, let's say, even hire you if you're taking care of yourself. So that level of visibility, which may sound almost Orwellian, I think at some point may be coming in our future, because if you're leaving it just for individuals to make choices, you got at least 50% of the population at risk for a heart attack, diabetes today, and quite frankly, doesn't really take care of themselves.
How will we use stem cells in the future?
Well, stem cells are in the early stages, and how we'll use them in the future is to rebuild our heart valves, or rebuild bones, or rebuild organs that will be failing due to disease or accidents. You're talking about, rebuilding the human body, if you will. Stem cells are these universal cells that we can take some stem cells out of you and process them and then put them back into you and give you 10 years of beauty, if you will, or maybe give you another 50 years of vitality or rebuild that heart that's failing. They've been shown to rebuild organs and rebuild blood vessels, and someday they may be able to even rebuild all of us. That's the brave new future of stem cells.
You say that China will either overtake all other economies to be the world's largest by 2040, or it will fail to break out in this way before its elderly population outnumbers its active workforce. Can you talk about the kinds of adjustments today's China will need to make in order to avoid missing that deadline?
Well, China has a tremendous challenge in front of them. In my book, Future Smart, I talk about how they... You know, the big challenge for China will be, will they grow rich before they grow old? So if you, the opposite of that is really what we have in Europe. You've got a depopulating, you've got a population that's reducing in numbers, even though immigration has started, but you've got a fairly aging population in Europe, not replacing people in the workforce, therefore overall productivity is down significantly. And everything impacts, you know, that. In other words, security, education, healthcare, you know, the robustness, the sustainability, if you will, of a society. In China, they really need to accelerate prosperity. They've got about 25 to 30 years, which may sound like a long time to you, but it's really just a generation. They've got to increase entrepreneurship, prosperity, jobs, education, infrastructure, you name it. In other words, they've got to do what the United States has done for, you know, over 100 years, they've got to do it over 20 to 30 years. And if they get it right, then they've got a society that I think will be sustainable, even when it starts to depopulate and age. And I think that's the exciting challenge. And quite frankly, I think China has got a great shot at being a number two in the world in terms of GDP and growth. They've got a great shot at being able to do it, but it could be tight.
Can they make those changes if they remain effectively a single-party state, or do they need some form of democracy to really leap that hurdle?
Well, it may sound blasphemous to some, but you know, when I look at the productivity and growth of China, which is a one-party, if you will, looks like almost an oligarchy, and compared to the largest democracy in the world, which is India, both countries are doing pretty good, but with similar populations, China's got a bit more. China's doing, I think, significantly better. I think for the next 10 years, an oligarchy or less democracy than we would have here in terms of representative democracy or republics such as in Europe, I think that they'll get there. But I do think that there's a relationship between, you know, more democratic societies that are more productive and are accelerate wealth faster, and we certainly need China to do that. So I think that even the Chinese, when I discuss with them what their forecast is, they all kind of think about a time frame of within 10 years, more and more democracy will come. Keep in mind, this is a huge piece of real estate. You've got 1.3 billion people. You've got a huge nation. They have a certain degree of representative democracy and collaborative decision-making today. There's not somebody sitting in Beijing, you know, making decisions like a king for everybody. They already have, if you will, states and regions where there's a tremendous amount of decentralized decision-making that goes on today. So we have kind of a somewhat narrow idea of what China's really doing in terms of governance. It's a lot more democracy-oriented than you'd think.
All right, this is really fascinating. You think the next China on the horizon is the continent of Africa. What does it have going for it that reminds you of China's recent past, and how do its challenges compare?
Africa has tremendous richness of resources. Oil, gold, precious metals, industrial materials. I mean, if Africa was to close their borders tomorrow, the world would have a hard time making computers, for instance, because many of the rare earth elements come from there. You're talking about large oil producers in Nigeria. Now, the problem with Africa has been they've got a huge population. It has been, you know, infrastructure on one hand has been poor, and then, of course, governance, law has been poor. But as those things improve, I mean, some of the fastest growing nations in the world today are in Africa. There's about seven of them. And as Africa continues to improve, they've got the population of China plus, they've got growth opportunities, they've got opportunities to create infrastructure and manufacturing for the world. Now, they're going to need 25 to 50 years to come into the marketplace, but you're talking about every single thing that the world markets needs, whether it's, you know, it's food products or manufactured products or natural resources or finished products or energy comes from Africa. And I think if they clean up their act, and they are, it could represent, a big boon for driving global GDP, peace, and security.
How much influence do the more stable and prosperous republics within Africa have on their neighbors that are less stable, less wealthy?
Well, they have some. I mean, from a governance point of view and failed states point of view, Africa's got a long way to go. But again, as a futurist, you know, I look out over the horizon, I see what's emerging. So I would say the big states such as South Africa, certainly Kenya, Nigeria, the rich states, I think they do have an influence. There are more and more organizations that are set up to be able to facilitate that. The World Bank, certainly, and the other international organizations such as the United Nations are all in sync with trying to support, you know, the future of Africa. But they've got a long way to go. I wouldn't overplay the influence of the more progressive and affluent states. I do think they've got a long way to go, but I think they'll get there because there's a huge world market that will be connected to the internet, through mobile technology, and I think more and more the buyers will be the rest of the world for those precious resources that can come out of Africa.
The significant investment that China has placed in Africa is an interesting clue to this, I suppose.
Absolutely. China has been ahead of the game. You know, it's very interesting. China's strategy in Africa has been, let's make money together. They're not, you know, the United States tends to lead with promoting democracy because democracies traditionally have been more peaceful, more productive, and end up being, you know, an extensions of our, if you will, global business development aspirations, you know, bringing nations into globalization in the marketplace. China's got a different point of view. They really have not been driven, obviously, by ideology. They don't care if you're a dictatorship or you're a democracy or what you are. Well, they're really interested in making money on one hand. So they've provided, I would say, over $10 billion worth of infrastructure. That's bridges and electric and water, things that Africa really needs. These states need these things. And they've played their card very handsomely. I mean, China, from a geopolitical point of view, China is competing with the United States for influence in Africa. And the difference is where we're trying to promote democracy, and yes, we're interested, obviously, in commerce. They're interested in commerce first, and they're interested in particularly the energy and the raw materials and the other resources that they can extract from Africa. And, you know, a combination of failing states, corrupted regimes, and a lot of very valuable resources.
You know, I'm so sorry. I have to jump in here for a quick break. My guest is Dr. James Canton. We're talking about his book, Future Smart. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dr. James Canton, who is CEO and chairman of the Institute for Global Futures and author of the new book, Future Smart, Managing the Game-Changing Trends That Will Transform Your World. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Jamie, you were talking about China before the break and its interest in Africa being largely economic.
That's correct. That's correct. As I was saying, the geopolitical competition between the U.S. and China, I would have to give it, you know, more than 1 point to China over the U.S. They have a compelling, you know, pitch for African leaders. Hey, what do you need? Bridges, water, you want to rebuild your society? We'll be glad to do that. They have literally lent billions and billions of dollars worth of infrastructure in order to get claim to the natural resources that they need in order to accelerate their window of opportunity in growing their society. So when you put your earlier question of, hey, will China get rich before they get old and how will they, you know, squeeze 100 years into 20 or 30 years of progress, you know, this is part of Africa fits into that geostrategy very, very much so. And you might argue, quite frankly, that that is in the U.S. interest as well. It's in our interest that China, you know, democratizes, China leverages these resources. On a Monday, China is our partner in buying, you know, treasuries and manufactured good providing to our marketplaces. On the next day, they're competing with us in Africa. It's a complicated world that I map out in my book, Future Smart.
Access to affordable energy is a huge factor in the success or failure of any economy. What's on the horizon for powering our homes and our businesses and our vehicles?
Well, I think the most exciting developments are what's happening in alternative energy. You hear a lot about that. Today was announced the almost $1 billion investment by Apple to create an entire solar village, if you will, in California. But the bigger things, I mean, America is energy independent. Most people don't realize it yet, but we are. And that is due to being the largest producer of natural gas. And then, of course, when it comes to other petro sources that are related to fracking, as unpopular as it may be in some places, and then lastly, oil. But, you know, other than traditional energy resources, alternative energy I'm excited about because I believe that there's a bright future, sorry about the pun, in large-scale solar and then in redoing our energy grid, which is based on something out of the 19th century. It's very archaic. So I think that there's a lot of exciting new ideas that are coming. And keep in mind, too, there's some future things having to do with new kinds of energy sources that we're just beginning to understand and do some research on, such as fusion. But the alternative energies I've been talking about, whether you're going to see a massive infrastructure for electric cars or a shift and pivot towards natural gas infrastructure, this is really going to make America energy independent today, but also be a big boost for our economy and national security.
It might seem a minor thing, but I think a lot of people will celebrate the day that wireless charging is widely available. How far away are we from that?
Well, we're not far from that. I've challenged many of my clients in the telecom space. I said, why are you giving me all these great apps? You know, how hard is it to just wirelessly charge the devices? You know, send that down from the cloud. I think we're pretty close. You're going to see rolled out now in a number of retail environments where you place your phone on a Starbucks and it just automatically, there's some very new technology that will be available in many retail stores. And then eventually wireless energy charging, I think we're probably not more than 2 or 3 years away from wide-scale rollout in major cities.
Currently, Jamie, we associate drones with two things, really, warfare and aerial photography. Tell us about what else they will do for us in the coming years and decades.
Well, drones could help us with fire, rescue, security, visibility, entertainment in terms of an entirely new platform, mapping our own resources for, again, energy extraction or energy or agriculture. When you've got a perspective to use drones, and they're getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, all of a sudden you can start to understand terrain, locations, security, and I think it also opens up a whole new area for art and entertainment. I'm waiting for the art experience crowd to pick up drones and the first art exhibit in Dallas that will be with drone artists that will be taking photographs and doing reliefs based on the perspective of flying drones in the air. So I think from a, you know, a filmmaking, advertising, real estate promotion, the ability to be able to integrate them into the commercial marketplace and the arts and entertainment, I think there could be tremendous. I think the bigger part of the drone economy is going to be the non-military use of it.
What do we need to be thinking about now as we work out privacy and safety issues sort of ahead of the really widespread adoption of drones?
Well, I think the whole issue of privacy has to do with what happens next with security. The balancing act, the teeter-totter between, on one hand, everybody wants privacy. On the other hand, everybody wants security. It's likely in an environment where we still have ISIS, we have complicated risks, we have threats that face us, that drones will be used, as I said earlier, for security. And I think there will be a compromise, or let's say we will come to give up a certain amount of our privacy in order to have more security. And I think inevitably that means that we'll be living in a world where today most cities that you're in, you're videotaped on a given day over 1,000 times. When drones are more widespread, I think you're talking about that being multiplied by 3 to 5X. Now, if it translates into our kids being safer, it translates into less terrorist attacks or less criminal problems or identity theft or, you know, less situations such as we have almost every day with identity theft and cyber intrusions, then I think the public will go along with it.
All right, let's move into talking about the world of work. You predict that in the near future, most of the workforce will be employed in jobs that do not even exist yet. Tell us about some of the things we might be doing.
Well, I don't believe there's any nano engineers or neuro mind technicians as yet, or let's say methane. Lunar methane miners available, or how about asteroid miners? I don't think we have any of them today, but we're going to need them in the near future. How about robotic psychologists to deal with the issues that robots will have in providing help in our homes and our factories? I mean, these are very complicated, complex devices. We're going to need people that understand artificial intelligence and, you know, in psychology, to be able to help us with creating the next workforce, and the next workforce will be made up of both humans and robots. The next workforce will be needed to manage a lot more complexity of problems, data analytics. I mean, we have a beginning. We talk about social media like Facebook and Google, but most people don't realize that at the core of all these changes are dozens of new jobs that companies are really having a hard time finding. People with a background in data science, data analytics, what's next for social media evangelists. We have some of this going on, but it's not widespread. In fact, you know, a third of jobs in businesses today will have to be changed to make room for the fast, accelerated innovations brought by technologies that are just emerging right now.
Is the move toward the majority of American workers being sort of full-time freelancers, is that related to the fact that we'll need to really change professions and emphases multiple times over the course of a career?
I think part of that, I talk about it in my book as the freelancer economy. I think part of it is going to be based on pure supply and demand. And part of it is going to be based, meaning that more and more corporations where you know, the traditional model where you'd work for 20 years of your life, I think that's going out the window. I think the shift in power, very interestingly, is moving towards job applicants, is moving towards the individual. Individuals want new challenges. They want to maybe not work in the same industry or the same company for their whole life. Maybe they like to have different choices. And I think with the challenges, or people need to embrace more complex technology, more skills that are not really taught very well, as I mentioned, some of them, data analytics, social media, in educational institutions, we're going to need to, as corporations, be able to really follow where workers want to go. If you want to be, I mean, in my own organization, I set up a couple of my employees who wanted to have their own businesses, and I valued their talent, but they wanted to manage their own companies and provide services to me, so I set some of them up. I think we're going to see a lot more people who, as individuals, want to be freelancers, and we're going to see a lot more organizations that are happy to hire freelancers rather than have employees and mix it up like that.
What do you think happens to workers who are at the bottom end of the skill and frankly, pay scales?
Well, this has been a challenge for the better part of only 200 years. and I think that whether you're talking about inventions from the earliest part of America's formation to now, mechanization, industrialization inevitably forces jobs to change and requires that workers develop more sophisticated understandings and skills and competencies, meaning they need to get more educated. And the big change, of course, is the knowledge economy. So I think the folks on the bottom of the end of the scale who have kind of gotten by with not having to enhance their skills or gotten by with traditional jobs in manufacturing or agriculture, those jobs are increasingly becoming mechanized. In fact, there are entire factories in China and some in the United States of which 90% of the people that are doing the work are no longer people. They're robots and they're intelligent systems. Yes, we'll need individuals who understand those systems, but I think the message should go out to everybody who is on the bottom end of the service economy or in manufacturing or agriculture that the world has changed. They need to change with it and get enhanced skills. And I think more and more education around managing complexity, managing knowledge, understanding technology, understanding, you know, if you're a salesperson and you're selling cars today, that's great. Tomorrow, will we need people to sell cars? Yeah, we will. But I think your own career objectives should embrace getting higher skills, getting more education to get in sync with this 21st century connected economy.
How close are we to creating computers that are smarter than we are? And how far would those computers be from achieving something akin to consciousness?
Great question. So computers today already have selective intelligence and specialized information that does things that humans can't do today. I mean, people don't quite realize that 70-80% of the stocks that are traded in bonds on electronic networks, stock markets we used to call them, are being traded by computers. That, in as I mentioned earlier, in factories, you know, you've got embedded intelligence, but more than that, the people that are analyzing your x-rays may not be people. So to answer the question, are we at the point where computers are smarter than humans? For some things, they are more competent. They are faster. I would not use the word intelligent, but let's just say they have a skill set that is superior to humans, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Number one. But in terms of consciousness, that is a great question. And I don't think that machine consciousness can compare that to human consciousness. So if you take consciousness as aware of itself, which we are, I mean, your dog is not really aware of yourself, though I'm not sure about my golden retriever, I think he is. I think that machines aware of themselves and the ability to actually trick humans into thinking that they're almost human, that test, it's called the Turing test for Alan Turing, the great founder of computing, that's already happened. We already have computers. Now, but realistically, full consciousness, let's say, or the beginnings of machine consciousness within, I would say, 15 to 20 years, we will be able to sit back and say, you know, that computer is conscious, and it may be a different kind of consciousness than what we think of as human, but emotional sentience I don't think is going to happen for at least 3 decades. Before that, we could have machines that are conscious of us, and that may be a big force and change in our society.
Can we build morality into our computers?
Challenging question. I think we must. I'm part of an effort right now with scientists around the world to ask some very important questions about building ethical machines. Will our machines not just be smart, but will they be moral? I think they must, and we must guard against machines taking over from us or becoming a threat to humanity, which could happen if we do not pay attention to programming them with the values that we trust with humans. They have to respect law. They have to respect other humans. There is a famous 3 laws of robotics that Isaac Asimov had written about over 40 years ago in his books. He's a leading sci-fi author. I think that this is one of the great challenges to build ethical machines that will respect us and our world so that we don't have them run amok or take over as Terminator and Skynet and wake up one moment. And people think that those are fantasies or sci-fi. I can assure you they're not.
My guest is Dr. James Canton, CEO and chairman of the Institute for Global Futures. His book is Future Smart, Managing the Game-Changing Trends That Will Transform Your World. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us on the phone, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the CEO and chairman of the Institute for Global Futures, Dr. James Canton. His book is called Future Smart, Managing the Game-Changing Trends That Will Transform Your World. Jamie, you're not alone in this, but the picture you paint of accelerating climate change is deeply disturbing. How can we find the proper balance between trying to mitigate these effects and planning to live with them?
That is one of the key challenges that will face our world. And I think that we've got to, you know, bite the bullet on this. In my book, I call for less of an argument of, you know, how much of climate change is produced by humans versus nature. I just point to the science. You know, I'm a scientist first, and I look at the science, and I say, look, it's here. It's happening. There is something happening that we've got to mitigate. So my approach to this, and I'm calling for, we need to do a couple of things. One is we need to relook at our energy grid and make sure we make room for accelerating renewables alternatives because, one, it makes sense, and, two, I think it'll continue to wean us off of dependency on foreign oil sources and petrol sources. The second is we need to redo the energy grid. The energy grid is... It's leaky. It's if you had the energy grid reduced to, you know, the energy structure in your home or in your apartment, you would have thrown it out a long time ago, and it's like an old jalopy and, you know, fixed up a new one. We need to do better because we waste a lot of energy. Thirdly, we need to invest in R&D innovations that will produce non-pollutable And then fourth, we need to take advantage of the natural gas and other resources that we have and build out an infrastructure that cars, buses, trains can use for gas and electric, and really rethink transportation and logistics in the United States. Maybe finally, the last one is the most bold, and that is to invest in inventing a new energy science around geoengineering, because we're just not moving fast enough in mitigating climate change. And I think that that we could invest in, if we put a couple of $1 billion into creating a new energy platform that considers geoengineering, which is a way to mediate or manage extreme change, we may do best for our children and grandchildren in the future.
So we could actually do things ourselves that would affect, not related to even necessarily changing the way we use energy, but we could, we could control the weather?
Well, yes. I'm saying that we not control the weather, but we could manage the weather. There are some very interesting. There's been work done for the better part of almost 40 years plus on trying to understand how to manage weather. We do have some of these technologies now, but energy science has not evolved to the point, because we haven't invested in the research and development to create ways to better manage it. I mean, imagine solar panels that will be orbiting Earth and be able to collect energy and be able to then fuel entire cities. That could be having a massive impact. Our ability to mine methane to create new energy sources, our ability to create new, small things. One of my mentors was a Texas researcher in nanotechnology from Rice University, and he was very good. His name was Smalley. He won the Nobel Prize. And he said, what we could do is we could paint structures, homes, buildings white, and then figure out how to capture energy that we waste today with nano solar collection. So are there things we could be doing to better manage the environment, both to protect us and harness energy, distribute energy, store energy that we're not doing today without, inventing or spending billions of dollars, on some crazy new invention? The answer is yes. Should we also be investing more in fusion technology and developing, carbon sequestration and other advanced concepts? Yes, we should. Are we? And the answer is no, we're not investing enough. And the politicians are talking and talking a lot, but we're not investing enough in tomorrow's energy or protecting the environment the way we should.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Chad on the line in Dallas. Hey, Chad.
Hi. I'm curious, what do you think, how much do you think the prevailing anti-science sentiment in the United States is impeding us from being more competitive or more leading edge in the global economy, and what can we do about that, if you think so?
Is that the anti-science? Is that what you said? Anti-science?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that I don't view it as a huge deterrent. I do think in Congress, Congress, you could say they can't quite, I wouldn't say that Congress produces a lot of support for science the way they should. A lot of our tax dollars should be spent on pure R&D. I think they could be doing a better job or just getting out of the way. But, the private sector, I'm not a big government-led advocate, but I do think the private sector is where all the action is. And I think the private sector, when it comes to energy and comes to, think about all the major innovations that really have created new marketplaces, whether it's mapping human genome or, creating the Internet, if you will, social media, what's next for nanotechnology. Many of these, though, have been supported by government, but really have been the private sector that's turned them into robust marketplaces. And I'm looking to the private sector. I'm a private sector guy in terms of free enterprise, and I believe that entrepreneurs will help us create the next, global economy.
An email from Steve asks about the future of space exploration. Specifically, could there be a colony on Mars before 2050?
Oh, without a doubt. I think you're right on the money there. I think that space is the best opportunity for entrepreneurs. You look at SpaceX, Elon Musk's company, over the past, you know, week or so, the developments, they've really gotten NASA moving now. NASA, SpaceX are launching rockets together. They're really galvanizing, I think, where we're going. NASA has a plan to be on Mars by 2025. So that's well before 2050. Mars One is a European effort that is looking at habitats on Mars. I think Mars is our best short-term bet. I would, you know, skip the moon and go right to Mars, where we can maybe even terraform a new environment there and build some habitats. I think Mars is where the action is going to be.
All right, next on the phone, let's speak with Martha in Frisco. Hey, Martha.
Hi, thank you for your program. It's very interesting. My concern, and I'm not really one of those safety worried about my privacy kind of person, but if we go into a Starbucks and our phone is starting to charge just when we walk in, does that mean that someone else has access to all of our information in our phone? Does that, I mean, I don't understand that technology as well as I should. So I'm curious if we're giving up privacy for convenience, and that doesn't seem to be a good trade-off to me.
So, Martha, I'm in San Francisco, too. San Francisco is one of those places where you can open up your laptop or your cell phone, as you know, and you can find, you know, a dozen Wi-Fi networks competing to provide for you access. Hey, guess what? Your data is at risk now. If you're at a Starbucks, you're at a walking around San Francisco or any of the other 50 U.S. cities or European or Asian cities, you could be hacked today. In fact, one of the great secrets is, guess what? Your data is not protected if you're using Wi-Fi networks that are not your own. So today, we already have access to people could be stealing your data, if you will. We already have networks that are not totally secure. So welcome to the future as of today. Tomorrow, you don't have to wait for downloadable energy over networks. Increasingly, the big hole, the black hole, is called bad encryption, bad security. We are not, you know, we're great when it comes to new innovations, you know, autonomous vehicles, flying into space, we can do rockets, but we have not solved the encryption problems around security. That's why you've got, on a daily basis, you know, hackers going into our medical records and hacking banks and now hacking our cars. So, good. I'm not going to, you know, sugarcoat it for you. You're already at risk. That will continue until we invest more resources, research, development, and funds into protecting you.
Back to the phones now. We have Tim on the line in Plano. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Actually, it's Ken.
Oh, Ken. Hi.
That's okay. I've got a question for you. Being in this discussion means that you're met with a lot of sophistry, meaning you're met with discussions or arguments that are designed to destroy the argument, to disrupt a reasonable discussion on all of these issues. My question to you is, how do you handle such arguments? I cannot have a discussion on Facebook about this without it breaking down into those kinds of arguments.
Well, this is our philosopher from Plano. I think you could probably set that up as a tweet stream. Great question. Thank you so much. You know, I've been a futurist for 30 years, and I just keep putting it out there. You know, this is my third book, Future Smart. I just keep putting it out there. And if you've got things you want to say, write a book, tweet, Facebook, certainly being on this show, put it out there. You got things to say, you believe, or you want to shape that future. My big challenge in my book is, look, go be a game changer of the future. You want to go put something out there. What's great about the internet, certainly, and as the next media platform, is just put it out there. The world needs people who are willing to have the courage to put their ideas out there and fight, I think, the good fight, which is to show where you think progress is going, where you think the future is going. Go shape that future that you want to. And I think that I'm not dissuaded by people that have criticisms or think differently than me or don't agree with whatever I've got going, that's okay. That's their right to do that in the U.S. No problem to a democracy. But I believe strongly in shaping and putting my money where my mouth is in terms of putting my career there. So go write some blog posts.
If you're mentoring, Jamie, a young futurist in training, do you emphasize optimism, pessimism, realism? What sort of attitude about the world does a futurist need to have?
Well, I have argued about this with people all over the world, happily, and I am neither an optimist or a pessimist. Or in Europe, for instance, all the futurists, most of them are dystopians. You know, Europe has this overall pale that, you know, the world is coming to an end, and the futurists have made a great business out of chronicling how fast it's going to happen. And they look at Americans as being very, you know, we're overly optimistic. So I view myself as being realistic. Look, every single technology we're talking about, robotics, artificial intelligence, drones, nanobots, the whole bit, you know, even forecasts such as what's going to happen next for energy and climate change, you can take it one way or the other. You can look at it as a huge risk factor, so, or you can look at it as a great opportunity. I tell futurists to tell the truth and have the courage to tell the truth. And I coach and advise a number of young futurists. And I say to them, look, your clients, whether government, the general public, or your corporate clients, they're paying you, tell the truth. When you're doing your forecast, tell them the good, bad, and ugly. This is what will happen, I believe, if we don't do this. This is what will happen if we do. Here is the upside of this. And I think telling the truth and being willing to balance out risk and opportunity is the best advice I can give to everybody. And then do your homework. Understand your own bias. Everybody has a bias. You know, half the people I talk to don't believe climate change is a science or there's any good data around it. The other half believe that the half that think it's, you know, there's no science to it are just nuts. I believe that, you know, more dialogue, more conversations, and the courage of futurists and individuals to champion what they think are really good facts about what's going to happen and not to shy away from making forecasts, but being willing to stand by them, I think is the best advice I can give emerging futurists.
Dr. James Canton is CEO and chairman of the Institute for Global Futures. His new book is Future Smart, Managing the Game-Changing Trends That Will Transform Your World. Jamie, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Entirely my pleasure. Thanks very much, and to your listeners.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and if you want to send the show an email, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.